From the Free Speech Project at Georgetown University, this is Speaking Freely. I'm Sanford Unger. On this episode of Speaking Freely, we talk with Catherine Ross, a law professor at George Washington University, where she specializes in First Amendment issues, especially as they relate to students and young children. These concerns frequently surface nationally, particularly in the wake of major events such as school shootings. After the shooting deaths of 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida in February 2018, some students became instant activists, talking to the media, meeting with President Trump at the White House, and lobbying for new gun laws in Florida.
But you're not gonna knock us down, we'll get back up again. You may have heard us, but I promise we are drunk.
In February of 2017, President Trump repealed an Obama-era regulation that would have made it easier to block the sale of firearms to people with certain mental illnesses. I don't need a psychologist, and I don't need to be a psychologist to know that repealing that regulation was a really dumb idea. They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS! They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS!
12 days ago, 18 hours and 56 minutes ago, I was on the floor, scared for my life because someone walked into my school with an automatic weapon. I saw everything. I thank you for putting this bill together so fast to help keep me, my friends, and my teachers safe. I believe this bill is a great start, realizing that we all have to agree to disagree.
We will not be discouraged. We will not falter. We will not stop this movement, because this is more than just us. This is everybody in America. This is for every single kid who fears for their life.
With other shootings by this point, most people would have forgotten about us, but not this time. My classmates and I are probably the most determined group of people you will ever meet. People are talking about how we aren't serious because we're children.
Because we know there can be change in this country. Never again should a tragedy of this caliber happen in this country. Never again.
We will shine.
That was the Stoneman Douglas Drama Club performing Shine, a song they wrote after the loss of 17 students and teachers at their school. They performed it at a CNN town hall just days after the murders. We also heard from students Emma Gonzalez, Annabelle Claprud, Alfonso Calderon, Sophie Whitney, and Lorenzo Prado. Stoneman Douglas students have appeared frequently on television and radio and lobbied lawmakers, demanding they do something about easy access to guns in Florida and elsewhere. In past school shooting incidents, students affected have rarely been heard from. But in this case, the student voices in public debate have had a significant effect on national opinion on gun laws. Catherine Ross, our guest today, took an unusual path to practicing and teaching law. Before attending Yale Law School, she was a social and political historian and a policy expert on the needs of children. Ross says it was natural for her to take an interest in encouraging children to express their views and exercise their First Amendment rights.
I became a lawyer in part because I realized that a lot of my work as a scholar of children and their needs was really about the struggle of apportioning rights and the conflict among rights between parents and guardians of children, children themselves, and the modern state, which has a profound interest in the next generation of citizens, or at least should have.
Right.
That kind of interest. And so as a lawyer, when I was thinking about First Amendment issues, I was perhaps more acutely aware of the rights that young people have to express their own views.
Sure.
And the fact that they have views.
How would you define the ongoing abridgment of children's free speech rights?
Well, I have to start with what the rights are.
Sure.
And they have rights in school, which is their primary contact with the government. We have to remember that the right to free speech is only between the individual and the government.
Of course.
A child doesn't have the right to say whatever they want to their parents. In school, which is their primary contact with the government, students have a right to say what they want so long as they do not disrupt the ongoing work of the school, which is education. And the Supreme Court held that, you know, more than 40 years ago. And then there are some exceptions to that for specific kinds of students.
What kinds
speech.
Of exceptions are there?
If the school is understood to be sponsoring the speech and having approved it, let's say, in the school newspaper, then they can censor for any legitimate pedagogical reason. Students are not allowed to advocate substance abuse unless it's a political statement, like
right.
legalize drugs now. Those are the main ones. But I'd also say that even before that decision, which is Tinker versus Des Moines, that's,
right.
that some of your listeners might be aware of, back in the 1940s, in a case involving Jehovah's Witnesses who didn't want to salute the flag that has
West
been
Virginia
much...
West Virginia Board of Education versus
Barnett. The court said people, including school children, have the right not to participate in patriotic exercises to express their own views, philosophies.
Right.
They can have many different reasons for doing this. And they said, in fact, that there is nowhere where it's more important to show that what we say about rights is not mere platitudes, but that we really mean it. We have to teach that to the next generation.
And Tinker v. Des Moines was an empowering decision for the political views. The Tinker children were wearing black armbands to symbolize their opposition to the war in Vietnam.
Yes, and they were doing it as part of a national Christmas time demonstration that was actually calling for cessation of hostilities during the holiday period that was
right.
organized by
right.
Senator Robert Kennedy.
Very important breakthrough in terms of symbolic speech rights.
Exactly,
for
let me
young
explain
people.
What symbolic
sure.
speech is. They were wearing armbands. They were not articulating with words, written or spoken. And symbolic speech means if you have an idea that you're trying to get across through a symbol, which might be kneeling or wearing a black armband, and the people who see your symbol will understand what you are saying, then that is speech just as surely as if you used words, and it has all the protections of the First Amendment.
So let's dig a little deeper then into this question of whether young children are being censored in this country.
School principals and school boards regularly silence speech that someone might find offensive, most commonly because one parent comes in and complains and says, my kid told me that this other kid had a t-shirt on and it was offensive to us. And it crosses every cultural divide, every political divide. It is equal censorship when you look at all the school districts, not within any single school district.
Mm-hmm.
So they censor pro-Trump t-shirts. They censored pro-Hillary t-shirts. They censor shirts calling for support for LGBT rights and shirts condemning homosexuality and so on, with abortion, with every high conflict, immigrants, pro and anti. And this is an absolute violation of the clearest rights. So there's some school principals who just don't know, and they aren't taught this in education schools, and that's a problem. But there's also willful disobedience on the part of authority figures who think they're doing the right thing and the law's wrong. And there's misunderstanding, and there I'm very sensitive because principals and teachers have to make split-second decisions
right.
if they think there's going to be
disruption. These are not easy jobs,
right.
and they're
not
often
easy.
On the firing line.
And they're not trained
symbolically
lawyers.
And literally.
They're not trained lawyers. So
right.
the teacher comes in and says, there's some sort of hubbub in the cafeteria. Can we shut it up? Somebody's showing a Confederate flag. Other people might be upset. What should we do? But then the schools dig in their heels when they realize that the law is not behind them, instead of saying, oh, let me now call an assembly and explain to the students what their rights are and how I misunderstood their rights. They hire lawyers and they fight in court. And so what they're teaching kids every day in our public schools is, we don't really mean it about the First Amendment, right? And you don't really have speech rights. You're only going
here.
To get in trouble. It doesn't apply here. And it's just a lot of high-flown talk. It's not about you. It's for the history books and the civics classes, if we ever still teach
but
civics.
But the implications of that are that all the dialogue has to remain very safe in the middle of the road, no testing of views or behaviors, or and that's not very good preparation for life.
It's not good preparation for life, and it's not good preparation for college. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is all this focus on what's going on with free speech and the lack of a free speech culture in colleges and universities. One of my concerns is, how do you expect college students to understand the norms of free speech and the legal meaning of the First Amendment? That it means you have to hear disturbing speech. You'll be exposed to it, and what you need to do is reply with more and better speech, bring analytical reasoning to bear, challenge other people's arguments. They can't know that because they didn't grow up experiencing it.
It strikes me as an interesting parallel to what happens to many young people when they get to college and they don't know anything about alcohol.
It's a great analogy.
And alcohol, they sort of, many of them become very irresponsible about alcohol, as some do, although I think the number may be exaggerated. Some become irresponsible about trying to suppress speech they don't agree with, or that makes them uncomfortable.
The numbers, you know, are not clear. When you look at the survey data, the most recent survey data says the vast majority of college students say that it should be okay to suppress speech
disturbing.
That is offensive.
That's very
disturbing. Begin by saying, we believe in free speech. But then when they're asked a more specific question, you should suppress speech that might offend. Even if our Constitution permitted that, which it does not, who gets to decide what's offensive?
Precisely. You argue that this goes down, this is not just a high school issue, that this goes down to much earlier years. And what are you getting at there? How are young children's free speech rights suppressed?
Well, sometimes by really silly decision making. So one of my favorites is a young boy, he was 6 years old, in the playground called another student a poo-poo head. He was suspended. It went on his permanent record, whatever that means when you're in kindergarten. So his parents sued. And the trial court said, of course you have the right to say poo-poo head. You know, what code does that violate besides the school's behavior code? And even a six-year-old has free speech rights. But his parents didn't really understand the First Amendment, because the next year the mother campaigned to get the book from which he had learned that word
banned
from the library.
So he wouldn't get in trouble.
So other students wouldn't be misled. And
Right. And did she win in getting it banned from the library?
No. Another example are elementary school students who want to talk about religion or want to hold a little prayer group or Bible study group during recess. And schools often mistakenly silence them, thinking that somehow the Establishment Clause prevents students from expressing their own religious views, which is just hogwash, for want of a better
term. They're frightened of
that.
They're frightened
of litigation. Three kids want to get together and talk about the Bible, and the school says, forbidden.
Right.
That's not constitutional either, and that's a form of speech.
These schools sound like pretty sterile places.
Yes, and you said they're bringing all the conversation to some
middle moderate
ground that won't upset anybody, and they're doing that in classrooms as well by limiting what teachers can bring in that's outside the formal curriculum. And so how do we expect citizens to grapple with really difficult and controversial issues?
Yes, when does the switch get flipped that suddenly people are able and have the
experience? You're supposed to wake up one day and know how to do this.
Right.
And so my real concern through all this has moved actually quite far afield from my original concern about kids in my first part of my career to a concern about our democracy, because active citizens, as Justice Breyer has called them, are the key. You need to vote, absolutely. You also need to engage and to get information and know how to process information and differentiate what a Russian posted on Facebook from actual serious coverage of issues.
Sure.
And if you don't learn to perform that analysis in response to speech that you don't like, or in putting your own speech together, you can't really function as a sophisticated citizen.
So there is one part of this topic that we haven't touched on yet, and that's bullying. And to what extent, if there is a suppression of speech in grammar school, high school, et cetera, is that to protect children from bullying or protect them from being stigmatized with some label that might make them unhappy and feel persecuted?
Yes, I think the adult instinct, which is a paternalistic instinct, is in many ways an understandable and a good one. But it comes into conflict with speech rights if the bullying consists only of words. And the Supreme Court, in a case that involved gender discrimination, but which also involved really unpleasant touching, and which the school refused to do anything to protect this 12-year-old girl. Most of the cases you read in court decisions about bullying are cases where there was violence and the school said we wouldn't do anything about it, and the parents say, don't they have to? And so ultimately the court said if the bullying is so pervasive that it interferes with access to education, then the school has a responsibility, but generally it doesn't. I was looking at a very different question. What can the school do? Does the school have a right to silence words that are hurtful?
In the name of protecting students.
So they're not punishing violence, but they are interfering with words on the grounds that this is going to be a better environment for everyone. And the problem
is... But the words could imply a threat of violence, could they not?
Well, there is a whole doctrine called the true threat. It's very hard to establish a true threat. But if it's something that any listener, or depending where you live, or that listener would understand, I'm going to come and kill you. That's
right.
A true threat. You can be punished for that. You can be silenced. But if it's, you know, you're ugly, you're a four eyes is one of the things that Justice Kennedy said in the case
because
about the gender harassment. We don't want to get involved, he said, in the everyday natural part of childhood where people call each other names. There again, where do we draw those lines? Now, some of them are racial epithets.
Sure.
Some of them are anti-gay things. Some of them are very, very hurtful. But there are other ways for schools to deal with that besides punishing the speaker. And the best way is to use bullying as a teaching moment, not to ignore it.
To teach tolerance.
To teach tolerance, mutual respect, to teach empathy, how do people feel, and also to teach the targets and the other people in the community what they can do. The most effective thing is for the bystanders to interfere and say, wait a minute, we don't do that in our school.
Right.
We'll isolate the bully.
To become unpopular because you're a bully.
Exactly, that
right.
It's not approved of. You're
right.
Not going to be elected president of the United States if you're a bully. We are also the only country that has a constitution that prevents us from criminalizing hate speech. Because the only way to decide what hate speech consists of is to allow the government to do that. And the unifying theme of freedom of expression is that it is beyond the government's control.
Well, and of course the question comes up that came up at the beginning of our conversation, who's going to make those decisions?
Yes.
Then when the speakers of hate, if we may call them that, are armed or carrying torches and intimidating
and I'm very glad,
people.
I'm very glad we got to that because I've been thinking a lot about whether recent events in Charlottesville, in Berkeley, other places, are game changers for my point of view and for the First Amendment's point of view. The answer is not yet, because there again you're talking about conduct. The conduct of marching in what was a Confederate state, carrying those torches, and having announced that there are members of the Klan, that is crossing a line from symbolic speech to conduct. In fact, Virginia has laws against
right.
walking with burning flames.
Right.
Those laws should be strictly enforced, just as universities ought to strictly discipline people who move from speech to conduct in a violent way.
Catherine Ross, our guest on this edition of Speaking Freely, is professor of constitutional and family law at George Washington University. She's the author of Lessons in Censorship, how schools and courts subvert students' First Amendment rights. For an extended version of this conversation, you can visit the Speaking Freely section of our website, freespeechproject.georgetown.edu. Our project is funded by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. I'm Sanford Unger. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Speaking Freely.
We're tired of hearing that we're too young to ever